The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke. Jesus said to his disciples, "Do not be afraid any longer, little flock, for your Father is pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your belongings and give alms. Provide money bags for yourselves that do not wear out, an inexhaustible treasure in heaven that no thief can reach nor moth destroy. For where your treasure is, there also will your heart be." The Gospel of the Lord. There are passages in the scriptures that I like to refer to as popular gospel cliches, lines, one-liners, or teachings that we're familiar with, that we often love to quote for, if anything, its poetic quality, but in some ways it's also very appealing for us to hear, such as, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love one another as I have loved you." And in today's gospel, we hear such passages as, "Store up treasures for the kingdom which thieves cannot break in and steal, rust will not corrode, nor moths eat and decay." And, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." These are pleasant sayings that we're familiar with and perhaps might like quoting from time and time again. But have we ever truly pondered such passages as those we hear in today's gospel? And in a society and a culture such as ours of mass production, mass consumption, getting the latest of fads, the latest technology, and so on, perhaps pondering these passages might touch us in very real and perhaps sometimes very personal ways. Reminding us, perhaps, that our faith isn't simply something we do just on Sundays, but is to inform how we live our lives, how we view the world, how we treat one another. One writer of the 20th century who I greatly admire is one such person who saw his faith as something very deeply rooted in him, and his whole outlook of the world was informed by that faith. This is an author known as John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, or as we know him affectionately as J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Much of his life and his experiences, in addition to his faith, are inserted into what he conveys in The Lord of the Rings. For example, he fought in World War I and experienced the horror and violence and destruction of war. And war is very much a part of the dynamic in The Lord of the Rings. He, of course, lived in England during World War II, when England was the last stand of democracy and freedom against the Nazis during the Blitzkrieg. And of course, the siege of Gondor and Minas Tirith is reminiscent of that, as Minas Tirith was the last holdout in the war against the forces of Mordor. He had a great love for the English countryside and was very distressed by how industrialization was polluting and decaying that countryside. And we certainly see that in how he describes the evil land of Mordor and the destruction of the forests done by the wizard Saruman in the forests on the outskirts of Isengard. But perhaps his greatest creation, which was his answer to what he saw as an encroaching materialism in the Western world, which we now know has completely taken over our Western mindset and culture, perhaps his greatest creation was in his development of the race of beings known as hobbits, which we had not seen in any other fantasy before, but was his creation for The Lord of the Rings. And among many different aspects of the hobbits, these are short people with great courage, who never wear shoes and prefer to walk everywhere, feeling the earth beneath them. Their homes are close and connected to the earth itself. They love good food, not because they're gluttonous, but because a great meal connects them with their friends and their neighbors and develops fellowship in their community. And in a book that I found a few years ago, it's entitled The Gospel According to Tolkien by Ralph C. Wood, He describes, among others, one aspect of the Hobbit's life and outlook that reflects very much the beginning of today's gospel that we hear. He writes, "As lovers of the good creation, the Hobbits are not consumers. They are not convinced that happiness lies in things that can be purchased and devoured. They are not getters and spenders who lay waste to their powers. Their sod-covered homes, for example, are built to endure and to be permanently occupied, not to be purchased as a speculative investment and then abandoned as soon as the owners can afford something better." Already in the 1930s, when he was writing both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien discerned that the materialist culture of consumption and convenience was triumphing in the West, and he offered The Hobbit's way of life as a witness against it. Another sign of a Hobbitic love for all humanly created goods is to be found in their refusal to throw anything away. They store seemingly useless articles for future use, calling their collected stuff mathom. But far from being junk that we would discard, these leftovers are precious matters to the Hobbits, for the word mathom means treasure in Anglo-Saxon. So little are Hobbits absorbed with their possessions that they give rather than receive gifts on their birthdays. Kind of like a combination party and yard sale. Their gift-giving enables them to honor their earthly goods without turning them into idols. Though they know nothing of the blessed life to come, they are not far from the kingdom in heeding the injunction given in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal." The simple life of these little creatures known as hobbits was Tolkien's counterculture, so to speak, to the culture of consumerism he saw growing in the West. And it certainly speaks to us in our society, in which so much of our economy is based on mass production and mass consumption. A culture and a society in which even Pope Francis himself points out a real danger of being a disposable society, a society of throwing things away, using things once and throwing them out, and even running the risk of disposing or casting out of the less desirable in our society, the poor, the destitute, the outcast. And Pope Francis warns us of that. And perhaps this is a good gospel and a good reflection during a year of mercy called by Pope Francis himself to be observed by the people of the church throughout the world, which we are now over halfway through, and we're coming into its last few months in this year. Some of the aspects of mercy itself that are part of our Catholic tradition speak very much to what Jesus is encouraging us not to be consumed with gathering material goods from this world, but to build up treasure in heaven where moths and rust do not corrode and thieves do not break in and steal. How many here have, in this year of mercy, thought to look up the traditional teachings called the corporal and spiritual works of mercy? Don't everybody raise your hands at once. A shame, of course, because we don't want to let years such as this go to waste. There's a reason the Holy Father has called us to this. But when you look at the corporal works of mercy, which you can find in this passage of the Last Judgment, with the exception of one that's added, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, welcoming the stranger, visiting the sick and imprisoned, burying the dead. All these make use of our earthly treasures, but are outward directed, not for our own aggrandizement or personal security or collecting of stuff, but sharing the treasures we have with those in need and feeding the hungry, clothing the naked. You look at the spiritual works of mercy, instructing the ignorant, correcting and admonishing the sinner, which itself is countercultural. In our world today, in which we are so afraid of being called judgmental or bigoted or unaccepting or closed-minded because we do not want to criticize anyone for anything ever at all, one of the spiritual works of mercy is correcting the sinner and calling them back. Not an act of judgmentalism, but an act of mercy as we look out for one another and do so in appropriate ways and leave ourselves open to that as well. Praying for the living and the dead, comforting those who mourn, and so on. Looking at the spiritual gifts that we have and sharing with those in need. Acts of mercy which reflect what Christ is saying in today's gospel and what Tolkien is presenting as he develops the race of little people simply called the hobbits. There are other ways in which we could perhaps, very practical ways, exercise what Christ is teaching us and perhaps imitate the hobbits. Ways that could be very, very revolutionary. Not just in our society, but perhaps even in your family. You want to see just how revolutionary it is. Tell your children, this year for your birthday, we'll do what the hobbits do. You won't receive gifts, but you will buy gifts for all your guests at your birthday party. Every year on the news, we hear around Christmas time, maybe one or two families that reach the news because they've decided this year for Christmas, they're not going to receive gifts, but they're going to give gifts. They're not going to open gifts at home and have a meal, but go to a soup kitchen or help the poor on Christmas. And if you want to see how revolutionary that is, tell your children that they won't be receiving gifts this year for Christmas or their birthday. They'll be giving gifts. And folks, just in case your children are now in the early stages of a panic attack, look at it this way. Kids, if you have one or two siblings with your parents, that's 4 days in which you're receiving gifts and only one day in which you're giving. But on a day in which they're the center of the universe, their birthday, it's something perhaps different to teach them rather than delving into the cornucopia quivering with desire and the ecstasy of unbridled avarice. They're learning to give. Simple, simple practice that can have tremendous ramifications where your kids are concerned, but a very deep, deep, profound lesson in which the value is in giving the gifts that we have, in addition to the fun of receiving. I have to admit, as I've gotten older, when it comes to around Christmas, what do you want for Christmas? Oh, I don't know. I'm more concerned with what do other people want, the fun of giving the gifts and things like that. And Jesus is speaking of that, and Tolkien is speaking of that. Of course, don't get me wrong, I love receiving gifts as much as anybody. But sometimes it is a great fun to give. And hopefully you get something that really has meaning, shows how well you know the person, and perhaps how well you love the person for whom you are getting the gift. But all these are various aspects in which Jesus is saying, build up that treasure for the kingdom. A treasure that cannot decay, cannot be eaten away, that cannot be corroded, and cannot be stolen. No one can break in and take it. And we do so by, in a way, detaching ourselves from the focus of a consumerist society, being aware of those who are in need, and recognizing the treasures that we have always from God and in corporal ways in the corporal works of mercy or spiritual ways in the spiritual works of mercy, taking those gifts and sharing them with those in need. It's amazing the effect on our souls that something as simple as that could have, in which it is far more than just a pleasant poetic cliche in today's gospel, but something we allow to take deep root into our heart, our soul, and our lives as we live in such a consumerist society, but grow in building treasures for heaven as followers of Christ.